Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
On today's episode of At the Margin, I'm joined by Dr. Flavio Tuxfer to discuss the economics of vaccines. Flavio is a lecturer in economics at Cambridge and has published widely on the economics of vaccines, immunisation and social distancing. There's something here for everybody, really. There's insight for policymakers, which to learn something about how to approach social distancing and immunisation and vaccine-related policy. Something for the nerdy economists who want to think more about how some of the various academic concepts apply in real life. And something for the current affairs junkie as we look through issues such as vaccine nationalism from an economics lens. Thanks very much to Flavio and thanks very much to all the patrons for keeping the show on the road. Patreon.com/at the margin if you would like to become a patron. Okay, I'll leave you to the conversation.
Very interesting and useful, I think, for a lot of people and people working in policy as well. We'll find it very interesting, but maybe we could kick off and just discuss the whole issue of economics of vaccines. So in most people's minds, I think nowadays we think about vaccines and we think that, okay, we just need to get the vaccines out there. But where does economics come into the situation in terms of vaccine rollout or vaccines in general?
Sure. So thanks first for inviting me to talk about these issues. It's much appreciated. So my interest in vaccines is part of a broader interest in the economics of infectious diseases, where we use tools from economics both to develop policies, but also to better understand how they spread in populations. And that basically boils down to understanding how individuals behave in the face of infectious diseases. So I've done a number of different papers that look at different aspects of decision-making and policy during epidemics. And so what these different papers have done, or these different research projects have done, is they've looked at the use of different interventions. So vaccine is just one of those possible interventions. The other ones that spring to mind are social distancing or lockdown policies and treatment. And so vaccine is just is one corner of that kind of larger research project. So my interest started from there, and so about 10 years ago, we realized that there was an important paper written that looked at vaccine rollouts from an economics perspective, and found that if you were to decentralize the vaccine decision, that is, if you were to ask people to decide for themselves whether or not they wanted to vaccinate themselves, then they would in fact choose to get vaccinated at exactly the same time as what would be considered socially optimal. And that was somewhat of a surprise, because economists have always used vaccines as an example of an activity that has strong positive externalities. And that would point towards vaccination decisions from individuals to be not necessarily aligned with those that would be socially optimal.
Okay, so just delving into that a bit deeper. So this is a nice example of where we have an underprovision of public goods, I suppose, in that I get a vaccine and it has a positive effect on everybody else, but I don't weigh that into my decision making. So therefore, my private decision making is not necessarily what's best for society. But this paper would have found that our private decision making aligns with what's best for society. In a way, maybe we're taking into account this positive benefit for society in our own decision.
So that's exactly right. So it turns out that that paper was written by Francis in 1997. It turned out that it rested on a number of very specific assumptions. And what my co-author and I found out, and that's Fred Chen, what we found out is that if we were to marginally change any of those underlying conditions, we actually would get to a situation where there was not social efficiency of decentralized decisions with vaccines. So in terms of a public good provision, that's exactly right. Now, the thing is, maybe I should finesse that a little bit. The vaccine has two main benefits. One is that it mitigates the effects of becoming infected. That is, it reduces the harms of being infected in the first place, for example, by reducing mortality or the likelihood that you will have to go to hospital. So that's one benefit. And that's a benefit which is primarily a private benefit in the sense that it doesn't influence disease transmission per se. The second effect of the vaccine is that it either reduces the probability of infection in the first place or that it reduces the transmissibility to third parties. And that's really where the social benefit of the vaccine kicks in, because when I now decide for myself whether or not to vaccinate myself, I might only take the private direct benefit into account, which is that I want to reduce the harms that come my way. But to the extent that it also reduces the transmissibility, then I also benefit others. And that's exactly where the public goods provision comes in, that if I were to take that into account, I would more readily vaccinate myself than would otherwise be the case. Okay. So that's exactly right. It's a classical example of public goods provision, or under provision in this case.
So your paper found that that classical example, there was a certain number of assumptions, is that right, that it relies on, that don't necessarily hold. What were those assumptions, or what was the deviation that you found?
So there were a number of assumptions. The first one was that the vaccine confers perfect immunity. So that meant that somebody who was already vaccinated would not care about the vaccination decisions of others in the population. Now, if you have a vaccine that only gives you imperfect protection, then there's still a residual risk that you face, even that you are vaccinated. And that means now that other people vaccinated themselves still benefits you, even if you are vaccinated. In a world with perfect protection, once you're vaccinated, you're no longer in harm's way. And so you don't care about others' vaccination decisions. So that was the first critical assumption. The second critical assumption was perfect homogeneity or symmetry in a sense. And that was basically the idea that everybody was identical in the population. Now, what that assumption bought there in this original analysis is that everybody would wait. They would basically trade off the costs and benefits of waiting another instance to get vaccinated, and that they would all get to a point where the vaccine decision would be triggered. That is, at some point, the risks of becoming infected were so overwhelming that it now justified a costly vaccine. Now, the problem is that if you have perfect homogeneity, everyone in the population is the same, then everybody basically vaccinates at the same time. Now, once everybody vaccinates at the same time, and if you have a perfect vaccine, that means that by definition, there's no one left in the population on which you can have positive externalities, because everyone is also vaccinating at the same time. And so if you were to depart from this perfect homogeneity assumption and say you have high susceptibility and low susceptibility individuals, then what would happen in a socially optimal plan would be that you first vaccinate the first group, and then at some point you would vaccinate the second group, which is basically what's going on today. Now, the thing is that when you have people vaccinated in groups at different points in time, then the people who are vaccinated later will basically benefit from the vaccination decisions of the earlier group. And that means that from a social perspective, you might want to bring the vaccination date back from that first group so that the second group can also indirectly benefit from it. And so this is another instance in which these very stylized assumptions of this original study break down in reality, and therefore there is actually scope for for a public intervention to correct these externalities.
Okay. So a lot of information there. Let me just try and get my head around it.
Sure.
So when I think about when you introduce these assumptions, usually it's the case of it means that behavior changes. But in this case, the homogeneity assumption, when we get rid of that, it's a case that the objective changes. Is that correct? So therefore, we have to maybe vaccinate those who are vulnerable first, as opposed to everybody at the same time.
So it is true that, I mean, in all these settings, it is true that the objective of the individual is different from those of the planner, because the planner, for example, like the National Health Service in the UK, should in principle care about the entire population, whereas each individual will typically care about themselves and maybe a small group of people like friends and family with whom they're in contact. But they will typically not take the benefits of the entire population into account. So it is true in all these settings that there are differences in objectives. Now, I'm a little bit hesitant to say this thing about the behavior, because early literature on vaccines actually disregarded behavior in a very specific sense. So it is true that the decision to vaccinate, in that sense, there is behavior. But many of the trade-offs that are involved in vaccines in the current crisis come from a different kind of behavior, which is the interaction between the vaccine decision and the alternative, which is social distancing. So, for example, for diseases like for vaccines like the MMR vaccine, in that kind of context, nobody ever thought that social distancing was a reasonable way of trying to avoid the diseases protected by the MMR. So there, the decision was really truly one of when to vaccinate and who to vaccinate. Whereas today, the trade-off is really not just whether or not to vaccinate, but it is also how the vaccination decision interacts with, for example, lockdown policies, or in the case of individuals, decisions of whether or not to protect themselves through social distancing.
Okay. That's quite interesting. There is a rationale then for public intervention. Essentially, I suppose it will be the take home point here. And that sort of intervention, is that along the lines of what's happening, or is there further lessons then from that interaction that policymakers could take in terms of making sure that rollout is efficient or maximizes welfare?
So. Indeed, there's a very clear rationale for public intervention to ensure vaccine uptake, because people would, under normal circumstances, some people might not want to vaccinate because they see very little private benefit, and because they don't take into account these positive externalities. Right now, the biggest constraint does not seem to be to get people to get vaccinated, although there has been some countries where vaccine uptake has been disappointing. I think at this point in time, the kind of the major issue from a policy perspective is to get a higher capacity, to basically get more vaccines available. There seems to be still, supply far being outstripped by demand at the moment. But let's say, if you were to disregard that particular issue, the kind of policy interventions that we could consider, of course, is the ones that, economists traditionally do in these contexts, which is some kind of Pigouvian taxes, or in this case, subsidies, extended to those people who are willing to take the vaccine. And that could be particularly for people who have very low private benefit from the vaccines, such as younger people who are less susceptible to to falling ill from becoming infected, and therefore would have the lowest private benefits from getting vaccinated in the first place.
That's a very interesting concept, because it feels like, just when you were talking earlier, it felt a bit like, because we're aware that we may be a vector of transmission and that might impact those we know and love, well, it internalizes that external effect to a certain extent. But as people get more people get vaccinated, and it's only the younger people that are left, that internalizing effect doesn't really... isn't as strong, perhaps.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Now, one thing I just want to come back to that you asked, and I think I didn't actually address, was this issue about prioritizing different groups in terms of vaccines. Now, in principle, as I mentioned earlier, there are different effects, or rather the vaccine works in different ways. One of them is it reduces transmission, and the other one is that it mitigates the effects of becoming infected. Now, there's an old debate in the literature that tries to settle the question of whether it is best to reduce transmission directly or whether it is better to give vaccines to the people who are most at risk, so the most vulnerable in case they were to get infected. And so this is a real trade-off, because if you want to reduce overall spread of the infection, you would want to target those people who are the most likely to spread the disease. Now, those people may not themselves be at much risk of becoming ill if they were to get infected. So think of people, for example, very young people who have very active social lives or who go to school and so on. These people, if they were to get infected themselves, might not have very severe consequences. The problem, of course, is that they spread the disease easier than people who have less or fewer social contacts. And so therefore, a decent argument can be made that what you want to do, even if your overall target is to reduce the number of infections of people who are most at risk, is by reducing transmission. What the UK has done, and most other countries have done, is instead of targeting transmission, they have targeted the people who are most vulnerable. So that is, we have prioritized people by age and by underlying health conditions and so on. And now we're working down kind of the different age groups, and we do it that way. Now, one reason that this has been done is that early on when the vaccine was developed, first of all, it was developed with a view of reducing the negative consequences of becoming infected in the first place. That was kind of the number one goal when these vaccines were designed. And second, it was not known early on whether transmission was significantly reduced. People thought and conjectured that this might be the case, but it was not clear. And now the thing about reducing transmission relies exclusively on that issue. And so if you're in a situation where you don't know whether a vaccine will actually reduce transmission, you cannot design a rollout policy that is predicated on the idea that it will definitely reduce transmission. So I think that, in retrospect, was probably a judicious choice a judicious decision in terms of who to give the vaccine to.
Yeah, no, I'm reminded of a comment when that the variant, what's known as the UK variant, is a disputed term, but when that was rolled out and people were saying the effect of a virus that once you contract it, it has more extreme effects versus a virus that is more transmissible, and the transmissibility increases the the social negative effects in terms of people getting hospitalized by a much greater extent. Almost it increases exponentially versus maybe a linear increase in terms of the effect. So I think that maybe feeds into this sort of trade-off here, where we're talking about we want to reduce transmission. Well, that can have a much wider effect if we can reduce the transmission. Would that be a fair analogy?
Yeah, but you need to know that it actually is possible, right? You need to know that the vaccine actually has that effect.
Sure. Okay. Yes. That's key. And that
is exactly the key. But you are right that there is this this little bit of a puzzling thing that diseases that are much more transmissible than others might not be worse. Depends on how the people who are infected, how long they have it for. So there are diseases that are much more infectious than COVID-19, yet there are fewer people who get infected, because the people who get infected, they pass away very fast and therefore don't transmit the disease to third parties. And so you get these slightly counterintuitive results that really the worst of all possible worlds is a particularly fine-tuned combination of parameters, rather than just being the one that has the highest transmissibility and the highest mortality and so on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
One thing that you've done work on that might be interesting to discuss is the issue of vaccine nationalism and how that plays out. Maybe you could just tell us a bit about that and what sort of work you've done in that space.
Sure. So vaccine nationalism is really just any set of practices that reduces or rather prioritizes a particular nation, over others. In things that have to do with an infectious disease outbreak. So it's called vaccine nationalism, but really there's a whole set of practices that are very similar in spirit, if not directly to do with vaccines. So for example, if you were to do an export ban on ventilators or on ingredients that go into to antiviral medicines or any such thing, even though they're not actually vaccines, they fall under the same category. And so this work came up because of this very rancorous, back and forth between the United Kingdom and the European Union about access to AstraZeneca vaccines. And so I thought that was interesting to look at. And there are some very nice parallels to other spheres of economic thinking, in particular to the theory of preemption games, which you might be familiar with from other contexts. And the idea is simple. It's simply that each individual country will weigh the costs and benefits of moving early, in this case with vaccine development, and the pros and cons are as follows. On the one hand, you want, of course, to get vaccines to your population as fast as you possibly can, and that involves, of course, putting money into research and to build up capacity and to sign contracts with pharmaceutical companies and what have you. But on the other hand, there are also benefits to not rushing this process. And those benefits come in, for example, early on in the vaccine development process, it's very difficult to know which ones are the vaccine candidates that are actually going to be paying off in terms of effectiveness and safety. And so there's a very large set of possible vaccines that one could, in principle, invest in, but you can't invest in all of them. And if you were to delay somewhat your decision, that can better inform this choice about which vaccines to concentrate on. So there is this trade-off between delaying and going quick for each individual country. Now, on top of that, there is the fact that vaccine candidates and vaccine capacity is very scarce in the short run. It's very difficult and very expensive to train people and to ramp up production capacity in the very short run. And so that adds an additional layer of urgency in the decision of each country, because they will not be able to benefit from slightly delaying these decisions, because they're afraid that they're going to be preempted by rivals. And so the UK in this particular instance moved faster than the European Union, and therefore, of course, had access to these very scarce production capacity that AstraZeneca had. So that was kind of the angle that got me into thinking about vaccine nationalism.
Yeah, if you're trading off the benefits of waiting versus the benefits of acting early, there are many aspects that feed into the benefit of acting earlier. Of course, there's the health impact and everything like that. But in a UK context, just after Brexit, it feels like, from a political perspective, this is a much greater value in terms of winning. So maybe, I wonder, was that a factor to play?
I mean, the truth is that any country within the European Union could have done what the UK actually did within the existing framework. Each country, remember, vaccines were traditionally not delegated to the European Union. And so each country could, in principle, have done that. And there was a choice to be made. And the UK was, despite having been invited to actually join the common procurement, decided to opt out. So I have no doubt that that was a strategic and political decision to go earlier, not just to secure the vaccines earlier, but also as an exercise in political signaling. And in fact, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, has subsequently explicitly said that it was Brexit that allowed the UK to do so well, although, of course, people disagree on whether that is indeed the case. But it's clear that as an exercise in political muscle flexing, this has been a very useful one for the United Kingdom.
Yeah. And just, I don't know if you don't know this question, this is fine, but it's something that I've come across in the past regarding the whole, when the Oxford vaccine was developed, it was suggested that they were going to release it, like the IP freely, but in consultation with government advisors, they were linked with AstraZeneca and it became private. I wonder, would that feed into that political aspect or not? Or is there any truth in that?
So I have read reports in the media that describe the whole process from the early. So indeed, it was an Oxford-based outfit that came up with the IP, and several decisions had to be made. And I know that there was strong pressure from the university's side to make the IP publicly available. I think they got to a compromise, which was to license it, or to basically to work together with AstraZeneca, who committed to actually not make a profit during the crisis for anywhere in the world, and subsequently in perpetuity for the developing countries. So this is probably the compromise they came up with. Now, what is true is that early on in this process, the Oxford team had initially made contacts with Merck, which is, of course, a US-based pharmaceutical company, who is one of the big companies that are already present in the vaccine market, whereas AstraZeneca had much, much less experience in vaccine production. And that decision seems to have been almost exclusively done because of pressure from the UK government, who wanted a UK-based company to be the pharmaceutical partner to Oxford. So that decision seems to have been almost exclusively made for what you could term, vaccine nationalist reasons.
Right. We're slightly tangential to economics here, but I want to bring it back to the economics that if it was a case that they went down this private route, that would mean that the capacity would be more limited, and therefore that would give more weight to this preemptive action then. So that's sort of my thinking on that, if that was actually part of the thought process.
So this is very hotly debated right now, whether intellectual property is going to make a big difference in terms of ramping up capacity. Don't forget that Pfizer, for example, has offered to make its IP available to anybody who wants to produce, and that has not created a large increase in production. Similarly, if there was unused capacity out there, And for example, AstraZeneca wanted to ramp up production, they would have ample incentive to do so, because they found themselves in hot water, of course, with having not been able to deliver to the EU what they had promised to do so. So it's not just a matter of intellectual property. They also have to have the know-how and to have you know, the capacity. It's not like producing car tires or something like that. It's a very delicate process. And so it's not so clear that intellectual property is you know, the silver bullet that's going to solve this problem in the short run. Yeah.
Okay. That clears it up in my mind. Okay, that was actually really useful. Thanks.
Yeah.
So let me just see. So you've done a lot of work on issues such as we're talking about social distancing and managing immunity. Maybe we can just move on to discuss some of the issues around social distancing.
Sure.
You've looked at what's maybe the optimal social distancing and maybe comparing what tends to happen in equilibrium, in that if we let people behave as we expect them to behave, versus what would happen if we have an optimal situation, that is maybe where we have a social planner deciding what's best for everybody and who's maybe can see everything with perfect foresight. Can you tell us maybe a bit about, well, what would we like to see and what maybe tends to play out in terms of what you found in your research?
So let's start maybe from one end and then chew our way through to the other end of fully decentralized behavior. So let's just look at what would a social planner do? What would a benevolent and well-informed and omnipotent social planner do? So typically in these models, let's just take for simplicity the simplest framework that has been used a lot in the literature, which is a model where you have susceptible infected individuals and recovered individuals, and this just assume for simplicity that recovery means that you are no longer immune. We can then talk about what happens if that is no longer the case later, because that actually changes the calculation a little bit. Now, what you would typically do in this kind of setting as a social planner is you're going to introduce lockdown measures in the case of lockdowns that is roughly proportional to the number of infections. And so what happens is that early on in the epidemic, you have moderate social distancing measures. As infection ramps up over time, you will intensify those measures. And at some point when you're over the hump, you will then relax those measures. So this has popularly been referred to as flattening the curve. Now, this is true. This policy is optimal in most of these models, even if you had no ICU capacity. So it's not an issue of trying to not overwhelm the health system. This is true even without having to think about that additional constraint. So that's what a social planner would do. Now let's talk about what an individual would do. Well, the individual, when faced with the possibility of an infectious disease, will basically make a cost-benefit analysis. And the cost-benefit analysis is fairly straightforward, which is that by reducing exposure to the disease, you reduce the probability of becoming infected with all the negative consequences of that. Now, what are the costs of social distancing? Well, that's basically not being able to go to work, not going to the cinema, not seeing your loved ones, all those things. Okay, we don't need to think about it just in terms of lost earnings. It's all the bad things of not conducting everyday normal life. Now, similar, in some sense, very similar to the vaccination decision, when individuals choose whether or not to socially distance, they will not typically take into account the effects that the decisions have on third parties. And so, again, we find an instance of under-provision of a public good. And this is exactly why many economists have argued for there to be government-imposed lockdowns rather than just letting the infection rip. Because individuals, even though they do have some interest in protecting themselves, that interest is not strong enough from a social perspective. And so you end up in a situation where a social planner want there to be more social distancing and happen earlier than would otherwise be the case in equilibrium. So okay. That's kind of the big finding in this literature, basically. So it's not just that the social planner would want people to protect themselves because they don't realize themselves that it's good for them. It's rather that even if people were to realize that they should protect themselves, even then, they don't have the strong incentives to do enough of it.
Okay, okay. And it's because of this external effect. It's because of the network effect of me passing it on to somebody else. That's
exactly.
We're not fully accounting for this. Okay, sure. Yeah. Okay.
So exactly. So if there was one individual on a desert island and that person were infected, then the social planner would have no more or less incentive to treat this person from the infection than the individual himself or herself, because there's no third party that this will have an influence on.
Sure. And okay, so we have this wedge between what's perhaps socially optimal and what's perhaps privately optimal, where we sort of fall in equilibrium if left to our own devices. And are there any ways, from your research, are there any ways that you can see how you can sort of tweak people's behavior to get them towards the social optimal?
So this is one of those situations where the economic theory is extremely clear on what you should do, but it's also completely obvious that it's very difficult to do in practice. So, okay. in some of my papers, I basically find instruments that exactly solves this externality problem, and it's a set of taxes and subsidies, Pigouvian types of taxes and subsidies that you can either impose on the instrument. In this case, say social distancing. So you basically incentivize additional social distancing by paying people, or you can do it directly on the health state. But of course, that's completely politically untenable. So, for example, these kind of subsidies would involve penalizing people who get infected by, say, levying a tax on them. Now, of course, that's a non-starter ethically, because you don't want to penalize people who are already infected by making their lives worse. But mathematically, it solves the incentive problem, because it tells people that if you get infected, you're really going to have a very unpleasant time, plus you're going to be taxed. And so it creates the right incentives ex ante for people to modify behavior. Now, in practice, of course, we can't use these very fine-tuned instruments, but there are other things we can do. And these have to do, for example, with providing the right kind of support for people who are infected to behave responsibly. So, for example, statutory sick pay, we know that people who are on low incomes, if they don't get sick pay, then they might be more willing to go back to work even with symptoms. So there's recent empirical literature that asks people to self-report these kind of behaviors. And indeed, you find that people who have additional support to self-isolate are more willing to do so. In another context, something very similar, the incentives to get tested. If you don't have symptoms, say, but you're getting offered a test, you might actually be hesitant to get tested, because you know that if you were to test positive, you're going to be required to self-quarantine and maybe name also friends and family who you've been into contact with and so on and so forth, which can have kind of consequences for them afterwards. So there are all sorts of different margins on which we can actually help people do the right thing, by structuring the fiscal and support system around people in such a way as to align with the incentives to do the right thing, purely from an epidemiological perspective.
Sure. You remind me of what has become common in the media nowadays, vaccine dividend, in the sense that if you're vaccinated, then you can perhaps engage a bit more in normal day-to-day living. But that is perhaps an incentive to get vaccinated, and helps, you know, these sort of, it perhaps is one of these instruments that could be levied in that context.
You're absolutely correct. So there are two kinds of such things that point in the same direction. The first one is, let's say, a policy mandated by the state that actually differentiates between people according to their vaccine status. That would be something like vaccine passports. But also, businesses themselves have now increasingly required both of their employees, but also of their customers, that they become vaccinated. So indeed, these are situations in which other things than just direct payments will actually incentivize people to get vaccines. And it's notable that most of the of the opposition to vaccine passports have not come from this angle, but have come from a civil liberties angle, which is that you should not differentiate between people, you know, depending on whether they've been vaccinated or not. Nobody has made the case, it seems to me, or at least not convincingly so, that that would be inefficient to make that distinction between people according to whether or not they have been vaccinated. So I completely agree that this is another way through which incentives can be provided. But again, it runs against this very heartfelt opposition to discriminate between people based on vaccines.
One thing then that you have worked on also is looking at immunity and how we manage immunity. And you've looked at the differences between treatment and a vaccine. I think, well, maybe, I wonder, could you perhaps just give us some insight into some of your research on that? And one thing that I find very interesting is how we manage it in anticipation of a vaccine, which is, I suppose, where we are at the moment. But
So there's a whole host of different issues. Let me maybe take them one at a time. The first one is the thing about immunity. And so the question really is, do we ever really get immunity? So most of the modeling that has taken place over the past year has used this famous SIR framework that assumes that people are just, you know, once they recover, that they're basically safe. Now, that turns out to specify a very specific kind of policy from the health authority's perspective, which is the one I mentioned earlier, that is, you ramp it up and then you basically relax after some time. So what I did with my co-authors, Chrissy Yanitsaru and Stephen Kistler, is that we took an extended framework known as the SIRS model, which is basically modeling the idea that after a time, after having recovered, your immunity to the disease wanes over time. And that typically takes, with many similar diseases, it takes about 1 to 2 years. So that means that if you've had COVID today, then in a year or two from now, you are actually, so you're back in the susceptible pool. Now, what that does is that it radically changes the cost-benefit calculation from the social planner. And the reason is as follows. So think of it this way, that each time you get infected, you're basically at risk of death, okay? And this is something we would like to avoid, and that's why we are willing to expend resources by closing down the economy and so on to reduce that probability. Now, the thing is that if your immunity lasts forever, then basically each person we save from becoming infected that recovers is safe in perpetuity and will never constitute a risk to third parties because they're basically immune. Now, when immunity wanes over time, then what happens is that each individual who can become infected is at risk of death today, but will also, if they survive, be at risk of death a year from now or 2 years from now, and again, 2 to 4 years from now, and so on and so forth. So what happens is that the you can think of it as the Grim Reaper coming periodically to basically harvest a part of the population, and it never ends. And so what that means is that protecting people from getting infected in the first place and controlling the infectious disease just becomes radically more valuable than the baseline model with permanent immunity. And so that just shows us that a seemingly innocuous change to modeling assumptions here makes a very, very important difference in terms of policy, that the cost-benefit analysis or the calculation just changes a lot depending on whether you model this the buildup of immunity or permanent immunity or not. So that's the first one. Now, in terms of the other work on population immunity, which I've done with Bob Rothon, my longtime collaborator, so what we look at there is we're trying to contrast the economic approach to building up population immunity with the traditional approach taken in epidemiology and public health, and I think maybe the easiest way to explain that is to work backwards and just explain what is the traditional approach and then maybe point out what we as economists think that is somewhat misleading about that approach, if that's all right?
Yep, sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So many people have probably heard this idea of the basic reproduction ratio, this RT parameter, which is basically a measure of how many secondary infections a given infection will create in an otherwise susceptible population. So we heard many times that the reproduction ratio is above one, or now it's below one. And this, of course, is a measure of whether we're infections are growing or whether they are on their way down. Now, the traditional approach taken in the public health literature is basically that if you can create conditions such that this reproduction ratio is less than one, in some sense, you've achieved what you needed to achieve. So, for example, if you look at the vaccination literature, they basically say that if you vaccinate, say, 86% of the population, then the disease will be eradicated. Okay, so this is exactly where these calculations come from. They basically ask, how many people do I need to vaccinate for this reproduction ratio to go below one? And this is known as herd immunity. Now, the problem with this type of calculation is that it completely confounds feasibility with desirability. And what I mean by that is that it does not actually, this kind of calculation does not take into account whether or not we want to control the disease. And if we want to control disease, whether we want to do more or less than is necessary just to obtain herd immunity. So let me give you two examples. Let me give you an example of very benign disease. Let's take, for example, athlete's foot. So athlete's foot is a highly contagious disease. Let's just say for the sake of argument that the reproduction ratio of athlete's foot is five. Okay, so that's far beyond the one threshold that we were talking about. Now, the question is, should we close down the economy and close all swimming pools for 2 years in order to eradicate athlete's foot? I think everybody would agree that this does not make any sense from an economic perspective. But that already indicates that whether or not we're above one or is really not what matters here. It's basically the seriousness of disease cannot be ignored in making that calculation. So let me now go to another extreme. Let's look at some disease for which the basic reproduction ratio is slightly below one. And suppose that it's extremely painful and extremely, you know, unpleasant to become infected. Would we stop vaccinating people when we just reach the one threshold? Well, surely not. It's so unpleasant. We would like to vaccinate many more people because by doing so, you actually reduce the number of infections. So again, we see that whether or not we're above one really is not the key point here. The key point is to apply whatever measure you have in mind, in this case, vaccines, so that your marginal cost and marginal benefit in social terms, of course, are equalized. And that may or may not lead to herd immunity. Depends on the kind of disease, whether you want to do that. And so in this work, we basically take this issue seriously, and we show that how much you want to treat or how much you want to vaccinate depends not just on the infectiousness of the disease, which is caught by kind of the properties of the disease and so on, but it also depends on whether this is a disease that just is very unpleasant. So that's what that work basically does.
Okay, that sort of relates to some thoughts that I've had recently, in that if we're in a situation where vulnerable people are vaccinated and the chance of hospitalization is quite low, well, then we're in a world where COVID-19 is something that people get mild cases of, and therefore, if the reproduction rate is five, like athlete's foot, well, then it's less of a concern than if it's quite low or not.
That's exactly right. It's almost so, you know, so commonsensical that we almost shouldn't even talk about it, right? If a disease is, let's in the extreme case of an infectious disease that has almost no symptoms, we don't care how infectious it is because it doesn't change anyone's lives, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, not maybe in a small way, but in a way that can be managed.
Let's just think of a fictitious disease that whenever you get infected, you get an extra freckle. Okay, that's all it does.
Right, okay.
Right? Well, and yeah, suppose sure. It has a reproduction ratio of 200, we would only write about this as a curiosity. We wouldn't actually do anything about it, right?
Sure. If we're approaching a situation where, like what we're in now, and we're hopefully getting to a stage where people are getting vaccines, and we can see in countries that have high rollouts that numbers are looking more favourable. How should we deal with social distancing in that context? What's the optimal strategy?
So there are two issues here. So I've written two different papers that kind of speak to that question. So one of them, it asks basically, suppose that we have vaccine on the horizon. So this is a work I've done with the Miltos Makris. So the question is, suppose that, you know, the vaccine has been now developed. We are a country that is waiting for the shipments to land in our country. And we're asking ourselves, well, given that we have 2 or 3 months left between now and then, what should we do? So I don't know if you remember early on when vaccine news seemed to be good, there was in some quarters, people were saying, oh, you know, help is around the corner. Now we can just relax. We've been saved. Okay. And what we find in our paper that this is just fundamentally misleading or misjudged. And the reason is that a vaccine is only useful for people who are susceptible. If you're no longer susceptible, you can't benefit from the vaccine. And so in some sense, once the vaccine arrives on the horizon, what it is optimal to do is to redouble your efforts to make sure that as many people as possible, within reason, can actually benefit from the vaccine. Let's just take the extreme other case just as a benchmark. Suppose that vaccine has arrived, but everyone has already been infected. Well, in that case, the vaccine is just not going to make much difference, right? You can't benefit from it because everybody who could get the disease already got the disease, and there's no one left to protect. And so what we show is that once the vaccine arrives on the horizon, you really want to ramp up your efforts in order to benefit from the vaccine. You don't want to relax your social distancing measures. You want to go the other way. Okay, so this is one insight I think is important and has clear, you know, political consequence or in terms of policy at least. Now the second thing is what it has been the experience after the actual rollout, and this touches upon an empirical paper that I've recently released with Chris Ault. And what we're looking at is what is the experience in terms of social distancing and policy after the vaccine has been rolled out. So we know, for example, that there are some countries that have rolled out very extensively, notably Israel, the United Kingdom, and some other countries, or US as well. Whereas in other countries, we're very, very early on in the rollout process. And so what we looked at is to try to figure out whether this rollout influenced two things. First of all, social distancing measures as measured by Google mobility data. And we also looked at policy stringency measured by the Oxford Index on Policy Stringency. And we found a number of interesting things. So one of the first things we wondered about is whether we could say that vaccines were being rolled out in countries that needed it the most, in the sense that these were the countries that had the worst kind of epidemiological situation. Okay, so they were rolled out based on need. And we found that once you control for income, that's not the case. So basically, the countries that rolled out most fast were also the ones that were the wealthiest countries. Now, this might not come as a surprise to people who have studied this carefully, but it's interesting now to have it quantified that this is in fact the case. Now, the second finding we found is that in countries that roll out faster, both social distancing and government mandated restrictions also are decreasing the fastest. And so that's perhaps not completely surprising. And the reason is that vaccines offer an imperfect substitute for social distancing. It's just that it is more effective than social distancing in slowing down infections. And it also is much, much less expensive, of course, because, you know, vaccines, you don't need to close down the economy just because people have been vaccinated, right? Now, what we have not yet found out is whether people relax social distancing because they themselves have been vaccinated, or whether this is a reaction to other people vaccinating themselves. So, for example, if you are in a household, say you and your spouse, if you get vaccinated, then you change your behavior because you're no longer at risk, but your spouse is also less at risk. And so the spouse might also change behavior. And this is something we're now trying to look at in forthcoming research, trying to tease apart those effects and figure out what are these aggregate changes in social distancing? Where do they come from? So that's, sure. that's still, unfortunately, not something we've completed yet, but this is something we're now working on.
Okay, well, that's really interesting piece of research. And just, I suppose I should flag, we've moved on from perhaps talking about what should happen to what has happened.
That's right.
For the economists who are listening and some who are really data nerds, it'd be interesting to hear how you went about that research. So you got Google mobility data,
yeah.
and you're for each country, and then what sort of, so did that data give you like micro data how people were moving around, and were you able to then use that?
Right. So the Google mobility data, which is free for all to use, and there's other data sets that basically do similar thing. It basically tracks people's mobile phones, and so against the benchmark of what happened a year prior, we know whether people spend more or less time in particular contexts. So we can, for example, see, let's just say, you know, in March last year, we could see that relative to the same time the year prior, when the epidemic started, people suddenly started spending less time in retail settings and in public transport settings and so on, and spending more time at home. And so that's why this is such a useful indicator of social distancing, because it gives us a rough idea of how much time people spend in context where one would expect the infectious disease to be a real risk. And so this is one of the many new data sources that have been used in the literature. Other sources include credit card transactions data, but also time, for example, in public transport, we know stuff about, and also footfall data on the high street. So there are all sorts of wonderful new data sources that have been used to try to map out social distancing measures.
So you take a data set of mobility by date or by time, and you match that with vaccine rollout and progress in terms of vaccine, and then you can, that's your research strategy, I suppose.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So we use it, we do it for 122 different countries, but the data is available at much, much lower scale. So you can do city by city. So you can go in and see, in Dublin, what happened in Dublin, compared to last year.
Versus the country.
Yeah.
Sure. So, yeah. Okay.
Unfortunately, we don't have we have not yet used a vaccine rollout for at city level. We do it by country level.
Okay, it's really interesting to see all these new data sets and networks that are established to share information post pandemic. But Flavio, well, thanks a million. I don't know if there anything else you wanted to discuss, but that was really, really interesting.
No, that's been, I think we've gotten quite a bit around this literature, yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, thanks a million. I really appreciate it, and thanks very much.
Okay, a pleasure, Niall. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Flavio, and thank you for listening. Until next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.